Mr. Griffin?
Yes, please.
And then Mr. Flax. We'll give Mr. Flax a minute to sign in. All right, counsel, you'll have 15 minutes. Do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Six, if I may.
Six, absolutely.
Thank you.
May begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm David Griffin. I have the pleasure of representing King William County and the Virginia Association of Counties Risk Management Program in this workers' compensation case. I have to just from the outset confess and admit to you that this is a tortured case. There's no other way to put it. There are many cases that follow a lot of very standard procedures. This, from the outset, has been different and challenging for both counsel all the way through. A lot of different issues that the commission doesn't usually address and that we don't see very often. So we all talk about this case among the workers' comp bars having a tortured history. Really, the primary part of this case, however, deals with really two major issues, a safety rule and credibility. And the safety rule was one that there was a lot of testimony about. And in that tortured history I talk about, the hearing began and went over and then had to be restarted again. That there's a reference to that in the transcript and in the deputy's opinion that she had taken judicial notice of the claimant's initial testimony. There is no transcript of that. So in her findings, in her factual findings, she found basically that the claimant was incredible. And she relies on a transcript that the appellate court doesn't have because it doesn't exist. And she relies on her judgment of the demeanor and testimony of the claimant.
I understand that you want to argue that. Where in the actual ruling of the deputy commissioner does she say that? That it's demeanor or appearance?
She doesn't use the word demeanor or appearance.
Isn't that a problem for you?
It is a problem for me. Because quite often the deputies don't use the magic language anymore because it creates problems on appeal. She says, in her opinion, that on balance, she does not find that the claimant's testimony is as believable as that of the...
But that can be based on things other than demeanor and credibility. And under 706, even setting aside under 706 without Goodyear, we wouldn't even be having this discussion.
That's correct.
The commission would be the finder of fact. But with the Goodyear window is a very, very small window, and you as appellate have the burden of entering the window. So what's the closest she comes to saying demeanor or appearance?
The closest she comes to saying that is that looking at the other witnesses as well, which the full commission never addresses. So you have another witness testifying, basically for the defense, disagreeing with almost all of the claimant's testimony. The full commission never addresses that. Counsel and for the claimant even calls that, I believe, the commission did not believe the second witness to be worth citing, is the way he dealt with that. But you have two witnesses now that are going into the great detail about the safety rule and the material. And logically, when we talk about what the facts are, you've got custodians that are supposed to clean. And they've been told, according to my clients, that they should never be on a stepladder because they tend to fall off. What's challenging is, in all the testimony, is that the county said, to do that, you use a squeegee. But the claimant says, oh, I was never trained in any of that. I didn't know any of that. But then she also goes on to say, but he didn't give me a squeegee this time. Well, if he hadn't given her a squeegee, and she's talking about that, but she says she never does it that way and wasn't supposed to do that.
That is a good argument of fact. However, if we find that you're not within the demeanor or appearance window of Goodyear, then don't you lose on the first two assignments very simply based on the fact that the commission is the finder of fact?
If it's just the two witnesses, yes. If it's just the claimant and our Mr. Purvis, our one witness, correct. But again, you then have to, the court needs to.
Well, right, but if there's any evidence in the record to support the commission's factual determination, and she said she wasn't told. Now, whether that should have been believed, whether the deputy commissioner believed it, isn't the issue for you that two-thirds of the commission believed it?
She also says, though, that, hey, I wasn't given one this time, and that she wasn't trained to...
Right, and that may be a discrepancy, but okay. It's clear that two-thirds of the commission didn't find it to be a faith one.
Our position on that window is that the issue of the safety rule is factually based. And to get there, you have to look at all the witness testimony. And if you believe, if the claimant is to be believed over Mr. Purvis, and let's say I can't get in that window for the sake of argument, you're still stuck with this other witness that also testifies about, hey, a ladder is not part of the tools that this custodian had, and goes into other detail about why and how she couldn't be doing that, which has never been addressed.
But that's a great argument for the trier of fact, but we're not the trier of fact. The trier of fact is decided.
It's a fact that's not addressed at all. But they
deemed it not worthy of mention. I mean, I know that's unsatisfactory to you, but that's a possibility.
It is a possibility. It's also a possibility that they neglected it, which is, again, the case was remanded a couple of times, or was remanded once to the deputy already to deal with. And that kind of brings to the other parts of the argument, which deal with the issue that counsel raised in his brief on stipulations. Now, the commission agrees that stipulations are not, you don't have to follow them. And normally what happens in the Workers' Compensation Commission is if a deputy commissioner decides she's not going to accept a stipulation because it's wrong, it's just wrong, which is what happened here, then the case is reopened and testimony is allowed so that both sides can present what was supposed to happen. That didn't happen here. That issue wasn't really raised by the claimant on appeal to the full commission. And the commission simply accepted and said, okay, well, we're going to overrule the finding of a stipulation, and we're going to enforce it without going any further. Again,
you will concede that you did stipulate to the two things at issue.
I will.
I
did.
Unlike the last time we engaged with each other, there was an agreement below in this case.
Right, there was.
Why should we let you out of the agreement? I mean, because doesn't that affect how everybody else proceeds?
For two reasons, if I may. The first is that, again, when a stipulation is set aside by the trier of fact, the original trier of fact, then the testimony ought to be presented, and the evidence ought to be presented by both sides so that the record is clear and so a decision can be made on the merits. If a judge says, it's kind of like in a criminal case, my wife works as a deputy public defender and she talks all the time about how they'll reach an agreement and there's a certain circuit court judge that says, no, we're going to have to hear evidence on this. And he resets it to come back. Well, if the agreement is set aside, just like in a criminal case, then you're supposed to come back and put on the evidence. And that's what should have happened here. So that's the first reason we should be let out.
Although the analogy is imperfect because we have two layers of trier of fact here.
You do. I concede that as well. And the second reason is that the stipulations that were entered into on one of the issues was that she had marketed up until the time of the hearing. And the commission took that to be, okay, she's relieved of marketing forever. That's not really what the deputy commissioner ruled. That wasn't what we had agreed on. The other issues, the stipulations, yes, we did agree to that. We were simply trying to move the case on. As I said, this has a tortured history, and we were trying to move forward with that. The final issue I just want to touch base on is one that counsel in the previous case described as a white elephant in the room, which in workers' comp is a huge white elephant, which we'd love for you guys to give some more direction on the economic loss rule. In this particular case, the jobs were eliminated, completely eliminated. They were outsourced. The county no longer engaged in custodial work. And so it's gone. And based on that, one other person applied for a job and was hired by this outside group. The claimant did not. But under the economic loss rule, the reason she's not working at that point isn't because of her disability. It's because the job disappeared. And under the economic loss rule, she's not entitled to a benefit that she wouldn't otherwise be receiving.
If the record demonstrated, I'm going to ask you a follow-up in a minute.
So okay.
If the record demonstrated that she wasn't rehired by the new contractor or hadn't been hired for other positions because of the injury, the economic loss rule wouldn't bar recovery.
Correct? That's correct.
Okay. Is there any evidence in the record to show that she wasn't rehired because of an injury, because of the work-related injury, either by the new contractor or somewhere else?
The evidence is that she never applied, that she didn't apply not only for the job, but with any job with the county at all. Not that not that her condition barred it, she just didn't apply. So we would ask that, at a minimum, the court remand this on the stipulation issue so that that can be heard. Otherwise, we would ask for a reversal on all the assignments of error, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or save them at the end. Thank you all.
Thank you, counsel. Morning, Mr. Flatt.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Flax. I represent the appellee, Linda Jones. First thing I'd like to mention is about the stipulations. There is no mention of the stipulations by the appellant in its assignments of error or in its brief. That truly is the elephant in the room. These are all concessions which were made by the employer at the time of the hearing that Ms. Jones relied on, and at the hearing, the deputy commissioner enforced. There were that she had a compensable injury, and as it pertains to the central issue that the appellant's raising, that my client was disabled to the extent that she was restricted to light duty. Those are all points which were validly accepted by the employer. In some cases, we were all responding directly to questions by the adjudicator, the deputy commissioner. For the deputy commissioner to then rescind her approval of the stipulations in her decision was the very essence of unfairness. There was no notice to anyone that she would retract her consent to it. It left Ms. Jones no alternative but to appeal directly, to enforce, as she should, the promise made by the employer to accept those issues as non-negotiable, really, that they agree to it. That's the whole point of stipulation, judicial economy, fairness, notice to everyone of what the facts would be that the adjudicator would then decide. I'd like to get to the issue of willful misconduct. The commission did make credibility decisions in its reviewed opinion. The primary witness against Linda Jones was her supervisor, Mr. Purvis. They called him evasive, contradictory, vague. And as you pointed out, the testimony by Ms. Conley, the other witness, about a job description which she didn't have at the hearing, couldn't know when it was written, was undated, wasn't really sure when she saw it, was deemed to be unworthy of even comment in its review decision. That burden of persuasion about willful misconduct is on the employer. That's why the employer's evidence was subjected to such scrutiny. Their witness was someone who said, maybe I trained her, maybe it was the other employees, maybe I trained her a few years ago, maybe a few years ago before that, maybe it was 8 years ago. Maybe I gave her a squeegee. I don't know where it was the day after the accident. All that's in the record, and all that was cited by the Review Commission in their findings of fact that the employer had no safety rule, training, and that there was no safety rule which she violated. In reference to the economic rule, a year ago the Court of Appeals ruled in Carr Atkinson that my client met the criteria to be eligible for lost wage benefits under that rule. She didn't have a furlough. She was let go, fired. They eliminated the position. It had the effect of terminating her employment forever, indefinitely, with King William County. Your point is, did she apply for a job? Well, the employer had a duty to provide selective employment. At that hearing, they agreed that she had a compensable injury by accident. They stipulated.
Isn't that true of everybody to whom the economic loss rule is applied? I mean, we don't deal with people who didn't have an award when the economic loss rule is applied. That's a predicate for it.
Yes, sir.
So then the question becomes, is the burden on a claimant in that situation to establish that the work-related injury is the but-for cause? What is your evidence that her work-related injury is the but-for cause of her lack of employment, whether with the county or someone else?
Judge, since the economic rule is an affirmative defense, the burden would be on the employer to show that. They presented no evidence about that, but what the evidence did show, it is the same evidence that justified the commission giving her an open award for lost wages, was that she was restricted to lifting 10 pounds with one hand. She could not use her right arm, could not use ladders, could not use equipment, obviously like a mop and a bucket, which requires two hands. Economically, she was clearly disadvantageous to other healthy employers.
What is the evidence of that?
The evidence,
because she was working light duty with the county when they changed the employment status of everybody in her department.
Yes, sir.
And does the record establish that everybody else in the department was hired by the new contractor except for her?
The evidence is that one person was hired,
but other people who had no work injury were not. That's what the record establishes.
That's right.
So how do we conclude from this record that it was the work injury that is the cause of her lack of employment?
Because, sir, under precedent sent by this court, if this was, again, an affirmative defense by the employer that would include their burden of proving that it was not the work injury, she met all of the requirements of the Carr Atkinson case. That is, this was an indefinite loss of employment, that she was partially disabled at the time it took place. The principle is just this humane liberal value that's inherent in workers' compensation law, that an employer injured at work, placed at this profound economic disadvantage to get other employment competitively with anyone who was not disabled, is presumed to have that disadvantage and has to seek work on her own within her restrictions.
Do you think Carr stands for the proposition that somebody who's on partial disability is presumed to be at an economic disadvantage and the claimant does not have to offer any evidence tying the injury to the lack of employment?
Sir, the Carr Atkinson clearly does say that the injured worker is at an economic disadvantage and is presumed to be eligible for temporary total disability benefits in the event of a situation like what happened at King William, where they eliminated an entire class of employees. I should say they didn't eliminate an entire class of employees. They just resumed it under another name. It was still the people's money paying for those custodians. It's not necessary for her to apply for a job there because the commission made its decision that her search for work in the general term was satisfactory. For her to apply for a job at the new employer would defeat the economic loss rule, because the whole point of that, strictly speaking, is that there is no job to come back to. And so,
well, then that would seem to be that once you have this partial disability status, if the job terminates, that it's unemployment insurance, and the Supreme Court of Virginia has made clear that's not the rule.
No, sir. You still have that duty to market within your residual work capacity, which the commission found that she did to its satisfaction.
Was there any evidence of marketing after the termination of the positions?
Yes, sir.
And where is that in the record?
It is in the record, sir. I believe in Judge, in reference to there was a reference on Appendix 216 that she was 55 years old at the time of the injury. Appendix 69, no office experience. Appendix 70, no recent retail experience. Appendix 69, no computer knowledge. Appendix 73-74, lived in rural county with few employment opportunities.
But none of those is evidence of marketing after the termination of the position.
Oh, yes, sir. They did find that the deputy commissioner found and the commission affirmed.
I'm asking you where in the record that evidence is that allows such a finding.
I think it's around page 200, Your Honor. I can't cite, unfortunately, the exact pages.
What was the evidence?
The evidence, Your Honor, was that she made 100 applications to employers in her rural community.
That was after?
After she stopped working, after she was laid off by King William. This was a community where the evidence showed that she would have to be driven by her husband 25 miles to submit a job application.
What about after King William got rid of the janitorial services?
That was that time period.
Okay. All 100 applicants?
Absolutely.
Okay.
There were 100 contacts. She registered with the Virginia Employment Commission. That's in the guidelines that the Virginia Employment Commission has. Her searches were 4 or 5 times a day, a week. That's in the guidelines of the Workers' Compensation Commission. She read the daily newspaper looking for ads. That's what's required. She found no light duty offered by any of the employers she contacted. Again, rural community, economically depressed. In the record, you have her testimony.
Does the record reflect why she didn't apply to continue doing the job she was doing with the county with the new employer?
No, it does not. And it's because that she was physically unable to do that.
Well, except she was doing at least part of the job at the time the decision was made to go from county employees to an independent contractor, correct?
Sir, she had many days that she missed from work during that time period, and to say that she met its requirements is a generous
well,
entitlement.
Well, we don't know because she didn't apply.
Yes, sir. That is correct. But by the same token, if you're going to give the new janitorial employer the authority, in effect, of the employer to bow that against her, maybe they should also take on the burden that the employer had of offering selective employment to her. And since they were acting as an arm of the county, that it was their burden also to make that offer to her. What the review commission found in its findings of fact was that her medical care had not been completed. It was stalled. The records are clear that she was in terrible pain. The records from her doctors were saying that her pain would be in high levels, that she had a crippling loss of use of her limbs, and that even her doctor...
Well, not to the point of being totally disabled. That's never been an issue, correct? She was...
I think some of the doctors did indicate that she was totally disabled.
Well, stimulation, though, works both ways, doesn't it? She was cleared for light-duty work during all of the relevant time period we're discussing now.
That is true, sir, but whether she's eligible for a change of condition is another matter. But you're right, that is not before the court. But, Judge, what is before the court is the knowledge that the commissioners had when they made their decision to give her this open award. They knew about the efforts that she had made, which had satisfied the deputy commissioner who ruled against her twice on other reasons. They knew the pain that she was in from because of her work injuries. They also knew that her medical care had not been completed, that Dr. Rice had recommended that she see a physiatrist, which is basically a pain doctor, etc., and a non-operative spine physician. You'll see that referenced in Appendix 202. And that Dr. Dahlgreen, her recommended neurologist, and a pain clinic. None of those recommendations were followed by the employer because, of course, they denied the claim and left her alone in a lifeboat. What the facts that the commission had when they agreed that she was on an open award was her age, her lack of experience in anything except labor, or a disqualification from doing labor because of her work injury, her search for work in her community repeatedly going to other employers unsuccessfully in an economically depressed area, showing that there was no opportunity for her, that the employer made no effort to offer light duty for her, and also that her doctors had recommended that she get additional medical treatment. Those are all facts in the record on which the commission ruled in making their decision. That was part of their findings of fact, which are binding on the Court of Appeals. Judge Russell, I understand the point you're making, but that was a factor that was considered by the Review Commission, and as a matter of fact, they felt that in the aggregate, the evidence showed that she was entitled to her benefits.
Well,
thank you.
Well, one last question on that. I believe in your brief, and I don't have it right in front of me, you can see that the economic loss rule is a mixed question of law and fact, which means we review it de novo and therefore wouldn't give deference to the commission on the ultimate conclusion, correct?
That's true, except the commission found as facts that it met the criteria of Carr versus Atkinson, that it was an indefinite loss of employment and that she was disabled at the time that change was made. So that to say the mixed question of law and fact is true, but it fit the criteria to a T of the rule of Atkinson versus Carr.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Griffin?
Please, thank you.
You've got a few minutes.
Thank you. I might first address a question that the court had raised about her marketing. She was found to have presented some marketing evidence up from July 1st, 2011 through September 7, 2012. That's in Appendix 88 and 89. But as of the summer of 2012, the deputy commissioner found, and the testimony was that she stopped looking for work at that point. And that's at Appendix 293, 352, and 355. So as of late summer, actually, because the deputy got into a colloquy back and forth with the claimant, you said you stopped working in the summer, but I see one job application in September. Yes, so September 2012, she stopped looking. To address the issue on the economic loss rule, the stipulation at Appendix 60 is that she was able to work light duty. She, in fact, worked light duty. And so that doesn't necessarily correlate into only being able to work light duty. The claimant was able to perform her work. The claimant's own testimony was that there was no light duty. That's at Appendix 61. So if she testifies that she went back to work after accident, but there was no light duty that she's working, she's able to do her job with pain, with problems, but she's able to do essentially her job.
What was the date that King William went from county employees doing these services to an outside firm?
The decision was announced after the claimant's injury, but the decision had been made before, and there's some testimony about that Brian Purvis reached out and called her and told her that the county was no longer going to be providing custodial services, and here's who the company is and who they can, if she wanted to apply for it.
Do you recall when the switch was made?
I don't recall off the top of my head. I apologize. But the record does show that she was informed of it before she came back to work after her accident, and she did come back to work. One final point that I just want to touch base on briefly is on the safety rule issue. The commission had ruled that the safety rule was not enforced. And that was another part of the basis for their decision that the safety rule requirement that is our burden of proof, is my client's burden of proof, wasn't met. But the evidence they base that on is the evidence of the claimant saying it wasn't enforced. We believe that the criteria for showing that a safety rule is not enforced means that the burden shifts to the claimant to bring in cooperating witnesses, which she couldn't do because they didn't exist.
Where, statutorily or case law, is there anything that says that the testimony of one witness, if believed, is not enough?
I believe that the case I cited in the brief talks about the need for corroborating witnesses on the burden to show that a safety rule is not enforced. I believe I've addressed that in the brief. I apologize, I don't have that case on the tip of my fingers, but I believe that's what the case law has said. And that simply was not addressed at all. Again, I thank you for your assistance and attention on this. If I can answer any other questions, again, once again, we would ask that you reverse the commission or at a minimum require the commission to remand the stipulation issue, but it would be easier just to reverse them and go on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down.
Thank you.
Thank you.